From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we discuss the environment in Iowa. My first guest is Carl Brooks, a newly appointed administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. He's in charge of the EPA's Region 7, and that includes Iowa and surrounding states. We'll talk with him about the agency's push for climate change legislation and how that could affect Iowa. Then a conversation with Rich Leopold, the director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources. What are your questions and concerns about the state's environment? Give us a call this hour, 1-866-780-9100. We get started right after this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad to have you with us over this noon hour. This hour, we discuss environmental issues in the state in depth. Later in the hour, Rich Leopold will join us. Leopold is director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources. My first guest is Carl Brooks, a newly appointed administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. He's the EPA's new Region 7 administrator, which includes Iowa, as well as Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and nine tribal nations. Carl Brooks joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Good afternoon to you, Carl.
Good afternoon, Ben.
We'd also like to have our listeners join our conversation this hour. Tell us your questions and concerns about the state's environment. Do you feel the laws and regulations we have to protect the environment are strict enough? Or can you point to a case where you think environmental concerns have overstepped other more important considerations? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Just to make sure we're all up to speed, Carl, the EPA is an agency of the federal government. It's charged with protecting human health and the environment, writing, enforcing regulations based on laws passed by Congress. The EPA was interested to find out. It was proposed by President Nixon and began operation in 1970. So we're celebrating four decades of the EPA. It has approximately 18,000 full-time employees. Tell us about this region you're now in charge of, divided into Kansas, Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska. Are there environmental issues that we have in common with those other states and tribal nations?
Oh, sure. Iowa is part of a much larger region here in the heartland, so many of the same issues that EPA tries to solve in Nebraska or Kansas or Missouri are those that Iowans are very familiar with. This region is a remarkably diverse stretch of the American landscape. We run from the gates of the Mississippi Delta down in Missouri's southeastern boot heel, clear out to the flanks of the Rocky Mountains. Across that 500,000 square miles, there are 14 million people living. So you can see the nature of the challenge that EPA has in front of it. It's a tremendous opportunity for the agency to work with people here in this part of the country. We think we're a good partner, look forward to helping make people proud of this place and look forward to helping it stay healthy and productive.
So let's focus on Iowa specifically. What do you see as the greatest environmental challenges facing our state?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to pick out a list of environmental challenges and say this is the most important, but I think most Iowans probably start with water and air and land quality. Those are the three that matter the most, I think, to Iowans.
Mm-hmm. And specifically, what is impacting those in our state?
In a negative way? Right. Well, water quality in Iowa is generally very good. That said, there are challenges. EPA basically has authority since the early 1970s to control pollution that comes from what we call point sources. A good example would be a sewer treatment plant or a factory. The agency, working with the state Department of Natural Resources, has done a really good job over the last four decades in throttling down point source pollution. So our grandparents back in the 50s and 60s would have had a lot worse point source pollution than we do today. The big challenge that remains in front of all of us in Iowa and all of us in EPA is what we call non-point source pollution. That might move off a parking lot after a rainstorm or off of a construction site around a subdivision. It's what comes off of farm fields during heavy rain events or snow melt. That's the challenge that EPA, DNR, farmers, contractors, everybody has to deal with, is the non-point source pollution.
Mm-hmm. And that comes to the fore, especially when we have periods of flooding, does it not?
It does. It spikes a little bit more then, although even the point sources from water treatment plants during flood events will spike, especially things like E. coli, a sign that there's bacteria in the water. You know, Iowa is in, fortunately for farmers in this state, a very well-watered area. There's plenty of rain here during the growing season. That's good in a lot of ways, but it also presents a challenge to controlling non-point source pollution because there is so much water on the landscape and moving across that landscape.
You mentioned cooperating, working with Iowa's DNR. We'll have Rich Leopold, the director of Iowa's DNR, on in the second half of our program. What is the relationship, help us understand that, between the state environmental agencies and the U.S. EPA?
Sure. It's a good place to remind people of a term they probably forgot when they finished high school government, federalism. Most American environmental laws are based on the idea that Congress passes national laws designed to make sure that every American has an opportunity to breathe pure air and drink clean water. Congress then, though, assigns the states the responsibility in most cases for getting to those goals. So at EPA, we delegate most of the responsibilities for keeping pollutants out of water to the state agencies that we work with. Our relationship with DNR is great. I like Rich. We work together well. He and his staff there are tremendous. They focus on the priority issues, and they have substantial responsibilities. Nearly all of the point source permits that dischargers in Iowa have to get are issued right here in Des Moines by DNR, not by EPA down in Kansas City or back in Washington, D.C. So that's federalism in action. National laws, national goals, but administered at the state level.
Are you ever in conflict when you, at the federal level, you have a mandate, something you want to enforce, to change, and the state doesn't quite see it that way?
We'd prefer to call it dialogue, not conflict.
All right.
Yes, we have good discussions with our partners at DNR frequently. It's just the nature of the federalism relationship that we might have ideas about how to accomplish some national goals that might differ from those in Iowa. I'd have to say that those conversations go on every single day. They're professional. They're respectful. We know that we can't do our job at EPA without a really strong DNR. I'm very pleased to work with Rich and Wayne Gieselman, who runs the environmental services side of DNR. We have professional discussions. I don't think you could call them conflict.
Okay. I wanted to go to a specific case, and forgive me, I don't know if you had a heads up about this, if you know the details from your position as administrator of this large region. But in April, the EPA ordered the former owner of the Chamberlain Manufacturing Ammunition Plant in Waterloo to clean up some contaminated soil and groundwater. Chamberlain's parent company, Duchossois Industries of Illinois, was ordered to provide ventilation systems to nearby homeowners because of a severe threat of lung problems and cancer even. Do you know about this case, and can you give us an update?
Well, sure. Not only do I know about it, our air division director is over in Waterloo today meeting with community members. I know that the cleanup is moving ahead, although I think that I heard from our air division director that there was some possibly unexploded ordnance discovered around the site today. So I do know that we're working really closely with the responsible party, and we've been working with the state agency to try to get that site cleaned up. It's a good example where federal law looks to a responsible party that operated a facility that polluted the groundwater and polluted the soil and holds them responsible for cleaning it up.
So how many EPA people are, in fact, engaged in this Chamberlain manufacturing site problem?
Ben, I don't have the exact numbers on that. I know it would be a relatively small handful supervising contractors who do some of the actual remediation of the soil and water. Don't have the exact number with me, sorry.
Can you tell us what the air quality director is doing specifically in Waterloo?
One of the main goals she had there was to make sure that residents who lived around the Chamberlain facility understood what was going on, had an opportunity to share their concerns, to ask questions, and to make sure that EPA was communicating to them about some of the environmental risks connected with the site. My boss, the EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, has put a real priority on making sure that residents of communities that are affected by past pollution have a chance to share their views, have a chance to visit with the EPA employees and the state employees who are putting together these plans to clean up these complex polluted sites, and don't feel that they're spectators, feel that they're actually participants in the process. We hear them, we communicate with them. And so that was one of the main reasons to see how that new effort is working over in Waterloo.
Now, the Obama administration is pushing for climate change legislation. Before we talk about that, how that could impact Iowa, what is the status of those efforts? Remind us of where that is in terms of pushing through climate change legislation.
Probably a good image to have in mind is that three-level chess game they used to play on Star Trek. Climate change legislation is working its way through Congress up on Capitol Hill. That's one level. At another level, EPA is carrying out a responsibility that was given to the agency by the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of years ago, and that is to use existing law, the Clean Air Act that dates back to 1970, to begin regulating some of the most significant greenhouse gas pollutants. We're on that track right now. A third track, I'd say, would probably be all the different efforts going on in this administration to help energy generators, businesses, and customers move through to a green economy based on all different forms of energy. That's one of the real lead roles that Iowa plays, because you generate such a diverse amount of energy here from traditional sources like coal and natural gas, but also, obviously, ethanol, soy diesel, and wind power, too. So there's a lot of different things in motion right now. People who are concerned about climate change kind of need to be reading all the pages of the newspaper and listening to the news all the time, because it's moving on many levels.
We have to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Carl Brooks, a newly appointed administrator for the Region 7. That's our region in the Midwest, including Iowa and a few other states, of the Environmental Protection Agency. When we come back, I'll ask more specifically how climate change legislation that may be passed could impact Iowa. Also, your questions. We want to hear from you this hour. Your questions and concerns about our state's environment. Do you feel the laws and regulations we have to protect the environment are strict enough, or perhaps too strict? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email. We're also on Twitter at IPRTalk. Back with Carl Brooks in just a moment. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. What are your questions and concerns about our state's environment? This is the hour to ask those questions. We are talking about environmental issues in the state in depth. First of all, Carl Brooks with us, newly appointed administrator for Region 7 of the Environmental Protection Agency. Coming up in the second half hour, Rich Leopold, the director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources. Get in touch with us. Our email is theexchange@iowapublicradio.org, 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number. We're on Twitter at IPRTalk. And Carl Brooks, let me follow up talking about climate change legislation, whatever that may be. Maybe it'll be passed this year, maybe next year, maybe never. How could, though, climate change legislation affect those of us in Iowa, Iowa business, homeowners?
Sure. One of the main effects, probably in any form of legislation that the Congress passes and the president signs, would be incentives to develop new forms of energy. EPA has been partnering with the United States Department of Agriculture to encourage and really ramp up the production of all different kinds of biofuels, that whole kind of spectrum of fuels that range from corn ethanol, the largest form that we're most familiar with, on through a variety of cellulosic ethanols. those have tremendous opportunities to save on the burning of traditional fossil fuels. They do present some of their own emissions challenges, though, that we're also working on. I think Iowans should probably support the enactment of climate change legislation that speaks broadly across the whole spectrum of pollutants there. I mean, every state that depends upon agriculture, like Iowa does, needs to understand that a changing climate with more erratic weather events is not good for agricultural production, and certainly not good for folks who depend upon an economy that really generates a huge amount of the nation's food and fiber.
A little over 5 minutes left with Carl Brooks of the EPA. Let's get to those calls. George in Williamsburg joins us. Good afternoon, George.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, it's my understanding that the EPA discovered in perchlorate water pollution at the town of Hills, Iowa, and that this was primarily an EPA investigation. Can you bring us up to date on the status of what is known about the perchlorate water pollution in the town of Hills, Iowa?
George, I wish I could. That's a specific site that I do not know about. I've taken a note here to look into the discovery of perch in the groundwater in Hills, Iowa. And I can communicate that information back through Iowa DNR, and it may be possible that you could check in with DNR as early as maybe this afternoon and find out more. Sorry, I don't know about the perch in Hills, Iowa.
Thank you, George, for your call. If anyone is wanting to know about a specific contamination, possible contamination, air, water, land in their area, can they go to a government website, the EPA, and really have perhaps a map and find it and see what the status is, if anything's being done?
Absolutely, Ben. The first thing they could do would be to go to epa.gov, and then there would be a Region 7 specific site they can visit. They can also contact our office in Kansas City, Kansas. We have a line that's answered 24 hours a day, and the phone number there is 913-551-7006 with a specific question about a specific place.
Let's go to Larry in Elkader. Hi, Larry. Good afternoon. Welcome to our program.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm concerned about the air pollution that is generated by confined animal feeding operations. There have been a number of studies that show asthma is much more prevalent in students whose schools are near these operations or whose homes are near these operations. There's a map that I've seen that shows essentially a ammonia cloud over the country centered on Iowa, presumably from ammonia from these operations. Is there something that the EPA is doing or could be doing to help resolve this problem?
Larry, there is. The EPA has been researching specific kinds of pollutants generated from certain kinds of animal feeding operations. Among them are pork feeding operations. That data, we believe, will be released here fairly soon, and it'll be accessible at the EPA.gov website. That is something that we think should be out within the next couple of weeks. Obviously, the agency is charged by Congress with making sure that our air quality laws keep up with the changing shape of agricultural production here. 40 years ago, when the Clean Air Act was first enacted by the Congress, there weren't really the number or the size of the feeding operations that we see now. We need to get the data. We need to see if there are, in fact, public health problems connected with these facilities. If there are, then EPA is responsible for making sure that the laws protect the health and safety of the people who live around these sites.
Larry and Al-Qaeda, thank you for that nice question. And I want to talk a little bit about, since we talked about climate change legislation, of course, politics wrapped up in a lot of the environmental legislation, laws and regulations. I came across this in 2008. The Union of Concerned Scientists said that more than half of the nearly 1,600 EPA staff scientists who responded to online to a detailed questionnaire reported they had experienced incidents of political interference in their work. And about 40% of the scientists reported that this interference has been more prevalent in the last 5 years compared to previous years. I wonder if you can comment, Carl Brooks, on how politics can complicate the efforts of the EPA.
You know, one of the great pleasures of working with Lisa Jackson as the administrator of EPA is her commitment to some of the cardinal principles that have made EPA for 40 years now a force for good and a deeply respected institution. She made it crystal clear her first week in taking office that the rule of law, public transparency, and letting science drive our regulation would be her hallmarks, the principles that she uses to navigate this agency. We've stayed true to those. Every employee in EPA knows that their mission is to follow the law, to be completely transparent about what we do, and to pursue the science where it takes us without fear or favor. I emphasized those same points back in February, just after I was sworn in to be the administrator here in this part of the country. I believe my colleagues in Kansas City and across the region understand that our job is to uphold the law, do the science, and apply the science to the law. Sure, inevitably there are disagreements in our region about how to do it best. That's great. I really do believe that when people disagree about environmental protection, they do it in a civil, vocal way because it's important stuff. We will not stand for interference with the work that our scientists do. It just isn't going to happen.
Our last caller for Carl Brooks, Dean from Dubuque. Good afternoon. Welcome to our program.
Good afternoon. There is a group of laws in place to clean up waters. Specifically, the 1973 Clean Water Act mandated that states clean their waters up. In 2003, a New York Times article pointed out that Iowa had some of the nation's dirtiest waters. And I might add that 16 years under Terry Branstad, nothing was done to clean up Iowa's waters, and nothing happened until the Iowa Environmental
Dean, we're coming to the end of the segment. Please, your question before we have to go.
Okay, well, there's a large creosote transfer and storage facility in Dubuque with creosote salt telephone poles sitting on the ground a block away from the river. I've talked to EPA, DNR, and other people. I can't get anything done about it. Creosote's the 14th most toxic substance. It's a toxic waste facility waiting to happen. Someday when they move these poles off, all that creosote is going to be in the ground.
Okay, we have just the time for a response. We get the idea. What can Dean do, Carl?
Dean, this is Carl. I'm going to go ahead and contact DNR as soon as I finish this broadcast to find out if there is some kind of an immediate water quality or public health challenge there. I'll also check with our water division on the creosote facility you mentioned right near the river. Thanks for bringing it to our attention.
Before you go, Carl Brooks, tell us, in your tenure at the EPA in charge of the region, which includes Iowa, short and sweet, what do you hope to achieve most in regards to this state?
Well, when I took office, I said that my responsibility as Lisa Jackson's administrator here in our four states was to make EPA visible, to protect our credibility, to make sure that when we moved out, we did it on the basis of the best science available and the best reading of the law, and to be a renewable, vital part of people's lives all over this region. Okay. Those are my goals, big ones.
Carl Brooks, thank you for coming into the studio today.
Thanks, Ben. Real pleasure.
Newly appointed administrator for Region 7 of the Environmental Protection Agency, Carl Brooks. Coming up, a conversation. We'll have Rich Leopold with us live. Your questions are continue to be welcome at 1-866-780-9100 as we discuss the environment. What are your concerns and questions about Iowa's environment? 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back with Rich Leopold of the DNR in just a few minutes. And we're back with the exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for tuning in this noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa has lost 99% of its native prairie and wetlands. That gives our state the unenviable distinction of having the smallest percentage of its original natural habitat remaining in all the 50 states. Tomorrow on this program, we continue in an environmental vein when we talk about what that transformation has meant for the state's biodiversity and about efforts to preserve the varied genetic material. And we'll find out what you can do to help preserve wild plant and animal species. That's tomorrow, Friday, on The Exchange at noon. Today, we're also talking about the environment, more generally about environmental problems in the state. In the first half hour, Carl Brooks, the newly appointed administrator for our region from the EPA, with us. Now joining us, Rich Leopold, the director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources at our studios in Des Moines. Good afternoon to you, Rich.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming in. We'd also like our listeners to join us this half hour with any questions and concerns about the state's environment. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Toll free, 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org, on Twitter at IPRTalk. The DNR in the news this week. A state audit recently found that the DNR is ignoring 16 state laws, issues such as the treatment of infectious waste, also a law requiring the creation of a toxic pollution prevention program. Some are charging that the failure of your agency, Rich Leopold, to uphold state law jeopardizes the well-being of Iowans. How do you respond?
That's correct. That was in the news this week, and it's some pretty serious allegations, and we're treating those seriously. As we look through what was actually brought up in the audit, the characterization of what this is kind of misleading. At no time has the public health ever been endangered because of what was brought out in this audit. When you look at things like infectious waste, for example, what the law stated that the audit brought forward was that the DNR was to put in place a permitting program, and then immediately following that, the legislature put a moratorium on such rulemaking. So we have not went forward. Now, as far as the infectious waste itself, it is being handled very responsibly and always has been from cradle to grave with departmental law, with Department of Public Safety, with Department of Transportation, and with the federal government and hospitals and clinics. So the same thing with the toxic waste. There has not been a problem with toxic waste. We have been firm in our enforcement of environmental law, and the public has not been at risk.
As quoted in the Des Moines Register, the state auditor says that the number of laws the DNR has failed to enact or enforce is longer than for other departments. This can't be a good reflection on your department, Rich Leopold.
It's true. It's challenging in context to talk about what this really is. When you look at Iowa code, at Iowa law, and you look at the Department of Natural Resources, there's a lot of it. We have a very large department with a very large scope of responsibilities, and we enforce the law that is given to us by the legislature and the governor's office. Mm-hmm. When you look at the items that were brought forward within this audit, we are dealing with those items, but they are largely administrative or political situations. They are not actual enforcement or work in the field that isn't being done.
So are you saying that this press, the raising of these issues, is political in nature?
I won't say that it's political in nature. I think that what was said was likely overstated. And I think we've got a learning curve within our DNR in looking at this audit. This audit is something that happens year to year, and a lot of these items are longstanding. I mean, some of these items go back to the 10, 20, 30 years that have been on the books that we need to change. And we are taking seriously the initiative necessary to change these items, to bring them up to date to what's really happening and the laws that are being enforced.
So this press will propel you to do what in a different way?
Well, we're working with the auditor's office. We're working with the governor's office. And once the legislature's back in town, we'll be working with them to change pieces of code that need to be changed to more accurately reflect the implementation of the public health protections that we have in place.
Rich Leopold of the DNR, so much rain. And again, today we hear it going on across Iowa, many parts. Has the recent weather, with all the rain, affected Iowa's rivers, lakes, and beaches? How has it been affecting those?
Absolutely. It's been another very challenging season to try to deal with all the different aspects of having these type of events. And not just the rain, but the type of rain. You know, when you get one cloud that'll sit in one place and dump 7 inches of rain overnight and things like that. We've been working with a lot of cities and wastewater treatment plants on storm sewer overflows or combined sewer overflows and things like that. We're working a lot with with bacteria warnings on beaches. In Iowa, rain means bacteria in the water, so we've been doing a lot of beach advisories and things like that.
So explain quickly the connection while we're there between the weather and those bacteria, E. coli levels when it rains.
And, okay, twofold. One thing is UV radiation from the sun kills bacteria. So basically in Iowa, the rule is if you've had a day or two of sun, you're good to go. All that UV radiation has killed the bacteria in the water, and they're at safe levels. When we have rain, it washes bacteria off the landscape into our waters, and that's when we get the bacterial problems, the warnings that you sometimes see at our beaches.
Okay, very good. Let's go to our first caller, 1-866-780-9100. Danielle is in Woodward. Welcome to our program, Danielle.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I've been a long-time water quality activist, and I think that our state legislature bears a lot of the responsibility for the state of Iowa's water. The DNR, to my understanding, gets less than 0.5% of the state's general revenues. That's not enough to do their job, and I'm very concerned about that. I think that there are... We're suffering the tyranny of the minority with groups, ag production groups such as the Farm Bureau, telling the state legislature how to behave. And I think the only way that will change is if urban residents and many other citizens around the state come on board and tell the legislature it is no longer tolerable for our children to get into Iowa's waters and come out with body sores, these cyanobacteria produced waste products and toxins that are very harmful to our health.
Okay, let's get a response from Richard Leopold. Thank you for your question, Danielle, from Woodward.
That's a lot of comments there. Within our state budget, I think we're at about 0.3% of the state's budget that comes to the Department of Natural Resources. We're a very large organization that has a lot of different income sources. Our general fund is not a huge part of our budget, but it's a very key part of our budget, and it leverages many other monies. So that's important. As far as recreational opportunities, you know, we've got a lot of challenges. And we do what we can with what we got, and I think we're making tremendous progress. And one of the things that I really want to say in relation to this, too, is we need people outside. Most of our natural resources, most of the time, are still in great shape. The hunting, the fishing have never been better in most of Iowa, and we would encourage people to get out and experience. But, yeah, we have a lot of work to do, too.
To follow up on Danielle's question, are you underfunded, especially with the state budget cuts? Do you need more resources to carry out your mission?
So asking a state director if we're underfunded, that's kind of a loaded question. But we do what we can with what we have. And there are aspects – when we have budget cuts, they affect different parts of our department different ways. So Danielle referenced the general fund allocation. Within our department, things that general fund affect are state parks, state forest enforcement with animal feeding operations, our state geological survey. So those are the aspects that could greatly benefit from more attention from our general fund.
This November, voters will have the chance to establish a constitutionally protected trust fund to preserve Iowa's natural resources. It's called Iowa's Water and Land Legacy. It's known by its acronym IWIL, and I think we'll hear that acronym, IWIL, increasingly as we head toward the November elections. Explain what this would do.
Well, the IWIL campaign, as I understand it, is to set up a constitutionally protected fund that when the legislature, if they choose, passes another 3/8 cent sales tax increase, would automatically go into this fund for specified purposes that have to do with natural resources. Now, the Department of Natural Resources officially has no opinion on this. We are, of course, a heavily invested state department in the results of this. What we do have is plans. We have a state wildlife action plan. We have a state recreation plan, a state forestry plan that have been, over the years, largely underfunded, and if given opportunity, we know how to accountably and effectively improve the state of Iowa's natural resources.
You said the word underfunded. How does Iowa compare with other states in terms of funding for conservation?
When you look at general fund allocations, we are one of the lowest in the nation. I've seen different comparisons that put us, you know, below 45 somewhere. It's hard because it's not really apples and apples. It's apples, oranges, and pomegranates. All different states are different in their funding mechanisms. But we in Iowa are definitely on the lower tier.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Justin is calling. From where are you, Justin, calling from?
I'm calling from Iowa.
From Iowa. Well, that's a big area. Any more specific than that?
Mason City, Iowa.
All right. Justin from Mason City, what do you got for us this afternoon?
I've noticed in some rural areas, especially here in my town, that some years the deer population is just tremendous. And I seen a year or two ago that they were considering have an extra deer hunting season to kind of thin the herd, and I was wondering why something like that couldn't be implemented in an effort to help prevent car accidents with deer.
Okay, the likelihood of more deer hunting seasons from Justin. Rich, what would you say to that?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Justin. Yeah, the deer population in Iowa is something we've worked really hard over the last few years to manage. When you're dealing with any population in nature, there is no balance. Nature's up or nature's down, and then we draw a fictitious line in the middle and say that's the average, that's the balance. We know that our deer population in Iowa has been too high. We brought back the deer, and we were successful beyond what we thought we were going to be, and it's went over what is what I would call a social carrying capacity, the amount of deer that we're willing to tolerate. We have been actively taking down that population. We've been issuing tens of thousands of additional antlerless permits every hunting season. We've also been working a lot with agricultural groups, the car insurance industry, and other on depredation permits and things like that. And actually, it's working. Most of the state has populations that are significantly decreased or are going in that direction. Mm-hmm. Last year alone, we had a 17% decrease in the deer herd from our hunting activities.
So
we are bringing that population down.
Can you then see a corresponding decrease in the number of vehicle deer accidents?
The answer is yes. We are seeing that in the studies that the car accidents, especially in cities, are down. We're using a lot of special hunts within a lot of urban areas. We also see depredation, reported depredation from agricultural lands going down also.
Okay, let's go to our next caller, Heather in Mason City. Hi, Heather.
Hi. I was wondering, we're having so much problems, and we had a lot of problem in 08 with the floods. And I'm wondering now, with the floods that are happening in Fort Dodge, what the DNR has control over farmers' tiling and the lack of natural wetlands that we have?
Good question, Heather. Thank you. Heather from Mason City.
Yes, and a good question. In the flooding events, you know, when we look at over time, floods happen in Iowa, and they always have. The infrequency and the intensity are increasing over time, and I think we have to get used to what we are calling a new normal, that I think we're going to be seeing more of these events. On the other hand, people's memories are very short. It seems like 08 and the floods of 08 were like 30 years ago when you try to talk about land use policy and things like that. So it's hard to keep those in people's minds. When you look at tiling and natural wetlands and things like that, you know, we were 100 years ago actively tiling our land. We got the most productive soil on the planet, and we got great rainfall. It makes sense to. We were incredibly successful. We have a system now that's largely clay tiles that's falling apart, and there is going to be a major renovation. It's a transition period for what we're going to do with those tiling. We know a lot more, and we can do better when it comes to water retention, when it comes to water quality. I work very closely with the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship on how to keep our land productive yet get better environmental benefits, and that's going to provide for more strategic wetlands and things like that.
Okay. Our guest, Rich Leopold, for the remainder of the hour, director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources. I wanted to talk to you about this. As a bat lover myself, and I know there are a lot of bat lovers listening, the state's caves in northeast Iowa were closed earlier this year, we heard, because of a disease that killed about a million bats. Now, these caves, I know Maquoketa Caves State Park was affected, also caves in Jones County, Stars Cave near Burlington. Will these caves stay closed? When will they be reopened?
We're hoping to open them as soon as possible. What we're talking about is called white nose bat syndrome. It's a fungus that has been affecting bats in some parts of the country. And when this white nose syndrome gets into a colony, a population of bats, fatality is near 100%. This is an incredibly devastating disease. We know that it spreads naturally, slowly over time. But what we're worried about and why we've closed these caves is it also spreads because of people sometimes, we think. It comes on the shoes or the backpacks or headlights of spelunkers, you know, people that do this across the nation. We want to make sure that we are protective of our cave ecosystems before we allow that activity to continue. We're working nationally with academia as quickly as we can to verify the modes of transmission and the ability to absorb the spelunking, to take the people and let them back in the caves while still protecting the bat populations.
Can you be any more specific about when they'll be opened again?
I can't. It's one of those things that academia has to play itself out, and then we have to make a judgment call. You never have black and white. It's always a series of grays. And it's that when we feel our wildlife people feel comfortable and that the risk is acceptable to let the people back in, that we will. We also have a lot of recreational pressure. We know Maquoketa Caves is an incredibly important tourist industry in that area, and we're aware of that, and we want people to be able to enjoy. So as soon as we deem an acceptable risk, we will be opening those caves.
Bats are, of course, a very important part of insect control. Does fewer bats in the state because of this white nose syndrome mean more insects?
Well, and we have not documented white nose syndrome in our state. It's important to note that. We're doing this because we suspect, and we're doing this as a preventative measure. But yes, bats are incredibly important in the ecosystem for insect control. Of course, if you don't have bats, there are other organisms, you know, nighthawks or swallows or what have you, that will step up their activity with insect control. So nature abhors a vacuum and usually will rush to fill it. But we are trying to maintain the native bat populations.
The DNR is proposing a ban on alcohol at state parks and public beaches along the Iowa Great Lakes. It did during the 4th of July weekend. An emergency ban was denied this year. Why is this such an important issue for the DNR?
And actually this afternoon, the full Natural Resources Commission will be voting on a full-time ban for that 1 week during the 4th of July in the Okoboji's only. We were having a situation up there that we felt was endangering public safety, and we felt inadequate to be able to respond. We're not against drinking. We're not against people having a good time. We facilitate that in our state parks all over the state. But we were getting crowds of, you know, up to a couple thousand people, and when incidents would occur, we were unable to respond to public safety concerns. We were unable to get enforcement in if there was fights to break out. We were unable to get medical help in if there was an emergency and that type of a crowd. So we felt it necessary that we had to take that measure in the Okoboji's over the 4th of July. Now, whether this is going to involve other beaches and other times, I'm not sure. It is a growing problem in a lot of our areas and one that we're looking for help. We're looking for counties, cities, tourism organizations to work with us on what we can do about this.
Let's go quickly to this last topic before our hour ends. Your agency has an application from a former state senator in Scott County who wants to build a 4,800-head beef feeding operation and use technology from Europe to process the waste in what's called a digester. Can you tell us about this technology if you're familiar with it, how it works?
Methane digestion, yes. When you have a manure from an animal facility under certain anaerobic conditions, it produces a gas called methane. Methane is able to be, you can capture it, and then you can burn it for electricity to turn steam turbines or whatever. This is something that's being tried with dairies, with feedlots. They've tried it a little bit with the pork industry, hasn't worked too well. Actually, they've done a lot of it with landfills. You can tap into a decomposing landfill, capture the methane, and turn that into electricity. We do it right here in Des Moines.
How much energy is there potentially for the future for Iowa?
Well, this isn't a great yield. This isn't going to supply our energy needs, but any piece of the pie is appreciated. So it's taking what would be a waste product and turning it into a usable, environmentally sustainable project. And anything that offsets fossil fuel burning for electricity, I think, is a good thing.
Okay. Do you plan to approve this license in Scott County?
The license in Scott County is a larger construction license. When it comes to licensing and of animal facilities in the state of Iowa, the legislature has given us very specific guidelines. If a facility meets those guidelines, we are required, held responsible to passing the permit for the facility. We do not have a lot of discretion when it comes to the siting of livestock facilities in the state of Iowa. So this individual permit, we're looking to make sure it meets all the environmental conditions and meets all the legislative conditions set down. And if they do, then their permit will be granted. It's a matter of course.
Are these digesters, very quickly, we have to go in more widespread use in Europe, where the technology comes from?
I'm not real well versed on that. I know that in Iowa, we've tried it in a few different places, like in dairies in northeast Iowa, and it is producing a sustainable yield. You know, I think as we go forward in time, these are going to be more and more common, especially if we have some type of greenhouse gas regulation in the future. So you would have a financial disincentive to let it go and a financial incentive to burn it to make electricity.
Okay, we have to go. Thank you very much, Richard Leopold, for joining us.
Thanks, man.
The studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Thank you very much. Director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources, Rich Leopold. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Help in Des Moines from Sarah McCammon. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for the calls and the emails today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join us again tomorrow.